Chapter 7. Boats were waiting, and before night we were embarked on board the Cartel. This was an English merchant ship of 400 tons burden, called the Mary Ann of London, commanded by Captain Carr, which temporary berths between decks to accommodate about 280 persons. Some officers that had been on parole joined us at P, which swelled our number to 280. Here, past scenes were brought to remembrance. Away some 3 miles in the upper harbor were moored a fleet of old sheer hulks, ships of war unseaworthy and dismantled, where some 5 years before I had been sent, after I was impressed, to be held in readiness for actual service in the British Navy. Rather than submit to such unwarrantable oppression, at the midnight hour I lowered myself from the gun porthole of the middle deck of the St. Salvador del Mundo, an old Spanish three-decker, into the sea, thinking to swim these 3 miles and possibly land somewhere near the place where I was now, through the mercy and providence of God, embarking for my own native country. From this desperate effort for liberty, I was prevented, as already shown, and sent away among strangers with my character branded as a runaway from His Majesty's service. This side of that dark spot of dismantled ships lay moored the Swiftsure, 74, recently returned from her 3 years' station in the Mediterranean, the same ship to which I was drafted on her arrival in the Mediterranean, from the Rodney, 74, when she was about returning from thence to England, the same ship in which I spent my first 6 months' imprisonment, where I was threatened, if I would not comply with the urgent request of the first lieutenant, that I should be lashed in the main rigging, a target for the French fleet to fire at. As I was transferred to this ship because I had attempted to gain my liberty, as stated above, so I was informed, I should be transferred when she was relieved, at the expiration of some 3 years more, and thus I was doomed to remain in a foreign country, deprived of the privileges allowed in their service, such as paying their seamen their wages, and granting them 24 hours' liberty on shore, etc. But my sufferings in their prison had now gained for me what they were not disposed to grant, entire freedom and liberty from the service of King George III. England and America have done, and still are doing, much by way of compensation for such as have labored and suffered in their service. Millions of dollars were expended to carry on the War of 1812. Americans demanded and fought for free trade and sailors' rights. England acknowledged the justice of their claim, first by permitting hundreds who requested to become prisoners of war rather than remain in their service so to do. It was often stated that about 200 of this class of American prisoners were confined in Dartmoor. Secondly, by treaty of peace in 1815. But no remuneration was ever allowed for depriving us of our liberty and unjustly retaining us to fight their battles, except the small allowance of wages which they were disposed to grant. I was required to do the duty of an able seaman the last part of my service, and was told that I was so rated where I was stationed on the maintop. While a prisoner of war in 1813, the Navy agent paid me $62.71. This, including my coarse, cheap wearing apparel, for a mild climate, served me from what the officers call the sailor's slop chest, was all the compensation England allowed me for my services for 2.5 years, after which they held me a prisoner of war 2.5 years longer, treating and regarding me in the same manner without any mitigation or favor as those of our countrymen who were taken in privateers or in battle. But if England feels disposed at this late hour of my sojourn here to do me justice, it will be very acceptable. Our berths on board the Cartel were much crowded together, and were prepared for both sleeping and eating with a narrow passway just wide enough to admit of our passing up on deck and down rank and file. The next morning we weighed our anchor and passed out of the harbor under a cloud of sail with a fair wind. Very soon we took our departure from Old England, and were glad enough to find ourselves in the wide ocean steering westward. Nothing worthy of note occurred on board until we reached the eastern edge of the celebrated banks of Newfoundland, except the little sea larks which came fluttering in our wake, seemingly overjoyed to find another ship and her company on the ocean, from which they could obtain their daily allowance of food. How they rest in the night, if they do at all, is the marvel. Sailors call them Mother Carey's chickens, perhaps in honor of a good old lady by that name, for her kind care and sympathy for poor sailors. When a few days out, we learned from the captain that Mr. Beasley, our consul at London, had chartered this ship to land us at City Point, a long distance up the James River, Virginia, and load with tobacco for London. We considered this a cruel and unwarrantable act of Mr. B's, for only about 6 of our number would be accommodated, while the rest would have to travel hundreds of miles to reach their homes in New York and New England, if they could beg their way. We expostulated with the captain, but he declared he would not deviate from his charter to land us at any other place. The prisoners declared, on the other hand, that his ship should never carry us to City Point, whereupon arrangements were soon made among us in a private manner, in case of a revolution in our floating castle, who the captain and officers should be. As we approached the eastern edge of the banks of Newfoundland, about 2/3 of the distance across the Atlantic Ocean, I found we were in the place where I was shipwrecked by the ice several years before, as related in a previous chapter. As this perilous place became the topic of conversation, we learned that a number among us had experienced like difficulties in passing over these banks in the spring season of the year. Captain Carr said he had made 15 voyages to Newfoundland and never had seen any ice, and he did not believe there was any in our way. In the afternoon we saw a large patch of sheet ice. We asked the captain what he called that. He acknowledged that it was ice. As the night set in, the wind increased to a gale from the east. Captain Carr, unmindful of all that had been said to him respecting the danger of ice in our track, still kept the ship scudding before the gale under a close-reefed main topsail and foresails, determined to have his own way rather than lay by until morning, as suggested by some of the prisoners. Some 30 of us, unwilling to trust to the captain's judgment, took our position on the bow and bowsprit of the ship to look out for ice. At midnight the ship was driving furiously before the gale and storm, evidently without any hope of our having time to avoid ice if we should see it, and in danger of being dashed in pieces without a moment's warning. We also felt a marked change in the air. In this dilemma, we decided to take the ship from the captain and heave her to. We found him at the quarter-deck conning the ship. We briefly stated our dangerous position and told him that about 300 souls were at the mercy of his will, and now, if he did not round his ship too, we would do it for him. Seeing our determination to act in this matter immediately, he cried out to his crew, "Round in the larboard main brace! Put the helm a starboard!" This laid the main topsail to the mast, and let the ship come by the wind. This being done, the onward progress of the ship was stayed until the dawn of the morning, which showed us how narrowly we had escaped with our lives. Large islands of ice lay right in our track, and if we had continued to run before the gale, we should have been in the midst of them, in imminent danger of being dashed in pieces. The willfulness of Captain Carr was now evident to all, and the course we pursued in requiring him to heave the ship to was also justifiable. And after the ship was again turned on her onward course, and passing these huge islands of ice, we were all stirred to watch until we had passed the banks and were again safe in the fathomless ocean. These bodies of ice had the appearance of large cities in the distance, and had it not been for our forethought, would in all probability have been the cause of our immediate destruction. Moreover, a large majority of us were satisfied that this was the best time to take the ship from the captain and proceed to New York or Boston, from whence we would more readily reach our homes. For we had decided and declared, as before stated to Captain Carr, that his ship should never take us to City Point, Virginia, where his charter party required him to land us. Having passed beyond all danger from ice, the most difficult point for us to decide was which of the two ports we should steer for if we took the ship. Suddenly and unexpectedly, one of our company placed himself amidship upon the main hatchway and with a stentorian voice cried out, "All you that are for New York, go on the starboard side of the ship, and all that are for Boston, go on the larboard side." Sides were immediately taken when it was declared that the greatest number were on the starboard side. Hence, the ship was bound for New York. Captain Carr stood in our midst, nearby the man at the wheel, gazing at this unlooked-for and strange movement, when suddenly one of our number took the wheel from the helmsman. Captain Carr demanded that he should leave it immediately, and ordered his man to take the helm again. A number of us also urged our friend to take the helm, assuring him that we would protect him. At this, Captain C. became very much enraged, saying what he would do with us if he had a crew able to cope with us. But he saw that resistance was vain. We had taken possession of the helm. The ship, therefore, would no longer be steered by his direction. Seeing what was done, he called us a rabble, rough alley, etc., for taking his ship from him on the high seas, and wished to know what we were going to do with her, and who was to be the captain. Captain Connor of Philadelphia was lifted up by those who stood near him and placed with his feet on the head of the capstan, a cylinder 4 feet high with levers to weigh the anchors, etc. "There is our captain," cried the multitude. Said Captain Carr, "Are you going to take charge of my ship, Captain Connor?" "No, sir," was the reply. "Yes, you shall," was the unanimous cry. "I don't want anything to do with her," said Captain Connor. "You shall," was the loud cry, "or we will throw you overboard." "You hear what they say, Captain Carr? What shall I do?" Take her, Captain Connor," said the English commander. This being settled, Captain Carr began to call us hard names again. Some that stood near him advised him to cease and get down into his cabin as soon as possible, out of the way of danger. He did so, and order was soon restored. Captain Connor took charge of the ship and named 3 officers for mates. A number of us volunteered as sailors to man the ship, and we were divided into 3 watches, that every advantage might be taken to urge our ship onward for the port of New York under all the sail she could bear. Captain Carr and crew had their liberty and were treated kindly, but they were not allowed to interfere with the sailing of the ship. He declared that if the vessel ever arrived in the States, he would have us all arraigned before the United States court for taking his ship from him on the high seas. The idea of being deprived of our liberty and arraigned before our country for trial in this case on our arrival troubled us some. Nevertheless, we were resolved to keep charge until we arrived. A ship was seen bearing down toward us with American colors flying. We hoisted English colors. It was a rare sight to see one of our own country's ships with the stars and stripes floating at her peak. As she came riding triumphantly within speaking distance by our side, the cry was given, "What ship is that? Where are you from? And where bound to?" Answer, "From the United States, bound to Europe." "What ship is that?" Answer, "The Mary Ann of London, a cartel with American prisoners from Dartmoor, England, bound to the United States." A few more inquiries, and as each ship filed away for its onward voyage, we gave them 3 loud cheers. So glad were we to see the face of someone from our native country afloat on the wide ocean. About 10 days after the Revolution, or time that we took the ship, we saw the land looming in the distance before us. As we drew near the coast, we learned to our great joy that it was Block Island, Rhode Island, about 40 miles from our home. Sailboats were now pushing out from the land to get the first opportunity to pilot us in. Some of our number thought this would be a rare chance for them to go on shore in their boats, and so got up their hammocks and bags, waiting to jump aboard when they should come along. A heavy squall was now rising out of the northwest, so the topsails were clewed down, and many hands were on the yards reefing them. As the boats came sheering up to our side, the men on the topsail yards cried out, "Don't you come here, for we have got the plague on board." The men that were in waiting for them declared that we had nothing of the kind, and bade them come alongside. A multitude of voices from the topsail yards were again saying, "Yes, we have got the plague on board too. Don't come here." The boats immediately hauled their wind and steered for the land. Nothing that we had would induce one of them to come on board, for they knew that a bare report of their doing so would subject them to a tedious quarantine. The plague we had on board was this: we were expecting that Captain Carr would, as he had threatened, have us arraigned before the United States Circuit Court for piracy on the high seas. Therefore, we were unwilling to part with them until we learned more about the matter. The wind died away during the night, and the next morning we perceived that a heavy swell and current was setting us in between the east end of Long Island and Block Island into Long Island Sound. We now concluded if we could get a pilot, we would pass up the Sound to New York. From someone of the many fishing smacks in sight, we hoped to find one. At length, one of the smacks was induced to come alongside. In less than 5 minutes, she was taken possession of, while the captain and crew retreated away to the stern in amazement at the strange work that was going on. We judged that nearly 100 of our company began throwing their bags and hammocks on board of her, and themselves after them in quick succession. They then cast off from the ship, gave us 3 cheers, and bore away for Newport, Rhode Island, before we could learn their object. They had no idea of being brought to trial for piracy on the high seas by Captain Carr. As the wind was now unfavorable to proceed to New York, we concluded to go to New London, Connecticut, at which port we arrived the next forenoon and anchored off the wharf before the town, 6 weeks from Plymouth in England. A great number of us now crowded aloft for the purpose of furling all the sails at the same time. We then stood on our feet on the yards and gave 3 cheers to the gazing multitude on the wharfs in New London. In a few moments more, boatloads of our joyous company, with their bags and hammocks, were crowding for the shore, leaving their captured ship and Captain Carr to find his way from thence for his load of tobacco at City Point, Virginia, as best he could, or even to find us the next 24 hours if he still felt disposed to prosecute us for our so-called piratical proceedings on the ocean. Doubtless he was so wonderfully relieved at the departure of such a rebellious crew that he had no particular desire to come in collision with them again. The good people on the land seemed about as glad to see and welcome us on shore as Captain Carr was to get rid of us. But neither party was half as glad as we were. It seemed almost too much to believe that we were actually on our own native soil once more as freemen, free from British warships and their gloomy, dismal prisons. After our joyful feelings in a measure subsided, we were inquiring our ways home. Within 24 hours, a great portion of our company took passage in a packet for New York City. 4 of us, by fair promises, without money, chartered a fishing smack at $2 per head to carry 22 of us around Cape Cod to Boston, Massachusetts. This placed us beyond the reach of Captain Carr, or ever hearing from him again.